Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
David Foster Wallace says somewhere, I think it's in one of his essays, that he thinks about the essay as essentially a huge eyeball floating around its subject, attempting to see everything, you know, and attempting to describe everything. And I think you're right, you know, in his essays, which in many ways, I think like a lot of readers, I prefer to his fiction, even though I greatly admire novels like Infinite Jest. I think that in the essays, he perfects that level of extraordinary attention to the world, whether he's writing about tennis or going to a convention or an awards ceremony for producers of pornography, or whether he's going on a cruise ship to try and write about that experience. Whatever he's doing, he pays the most extraordinary, acute kind of attention. But at the same time, it's all undercut by this rather flatterish, self-deprecating, hugely intelligent and erudite, but somehow failing persona that he developed. And you see that formally in the essays, including, as you say, the ones that many of which are online, I think he wrote for magazines, especially in the 90s. You see that a lot of the time in the form of the essay, which kind of dissolves into footnotes and things in the margins. He's constantly kind of undercutting himself. And that kind of self-consciousness, I suppose some readers can find it a little annoying. I find it really endearing in his case, because it's like this is the same voice, but it's also, well, actually, this is the voice that is pointing to the great authorial voice and saying, well, actually, really, are you sure? Maybe not. There's a very, to my mind, human kind of self-consciousness going on in David Foster Wallace.
We tell ourselves stories in order to live. The insightful words of American novelist Joan Didion from her iconic book of essays, The White Album, published in 1979. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack the delights and mysterious allure of the essay as a literary genre with Irish writer, memorist and cultural critic Brian Dillon, whose latest publication, Essayism, has just been published by Fitzcarraldo Editions, and ask, how important is the essay to world literature? In Essayism, Brian Dillon argues, essayism is tentative and hypothetical, and yet it is also a habit of thinking, writing and living that has definite boundaries. It is this combination that I'm drawn to in essays and essayists. This sense of a genre suspended between its impulses to hazard or adventure and to achieved form, aesthetic integrity. So what makes for a killer essay? Is it possible to define? And is there a link between depression and the essay?
Hello, my name is Brian Dillon. I'm a writer. I was born in Dublin and I moved to England about 20 years ago. I teach at the Royal College of Art and I've been a freelance writer for the last 15 years or so. And in that time, I've published, I think, about 8 or 9 books, including memoir, cultural history, art criticism, and my latest book, Essayism.
Really well done on the book, Brian. It's always a fascinating read, I have to say. I learned a lot about literature and a lot about the essay as I progressed through the book, but also a bit about your own writing life and your own engagement with books. So hats off to you on that one. I might start with a big wide open question, if that's okay. Do you think a well-written essay can console in some way, that it can kind of arm us or clothe us and make us understand the world possibly in a more richer way?
I hope so. I think that's, in a way, the gamble that I was making when I set out to write a book about essays. One of the reasons I wrote this book is that it's always seemed to me, or it's always felt to me, that essay, or nonfiction more generally, was just as meaningful, both emotionally and artistically and intellectually, to me as literature, as anything else, you know, as plays and novels and poems. So I wanted to explore in some ways the history of the essay, in some ways how the essay works as a literary artifact, you know, how does it work stylistically, technically, and so on. But much more interestingly, I hope, was I was interested in what an essay might mean to a reader. And you picked up on the word console there. And so there are certain sections of the book that all have the same title. They're called On Consolation, and it's a strain of the book that's much more personal. Whereas elsewhere, I'm really trying to make an argument, I suppose, for the literary importance of the essay.
Could it be argued, Brian, that the essay itself is possibly the most ambitious literary genre that we have in terms of how it stretches ideas and also the reader?
I think you could make that argument. I don't want to make an argument in this book for the essay as being any more important than any other kind of writing. I think there are people who make that argument at the moment, who say that, you know, the essay is in a way occupies now the place that the novel might have a few decades ago. I think that the essay is ambitious in the sense that it often starts from simply saying I, you know, the author pointing to herself or himself, starting from their own experience. And from there, it might go literally anywhere. The essay can be about tiny details of the world. It can be about the universe, the cosmos. And I suppose that what I'm interested in is the movement back and forth, you know, between big ideas and very tiny details, between the kind of urgency to tell one's own story on the one hand, to get something out into the world in all its kind of messiness or chaos. And on the other hand, an ambition to be as precise, as formally exacting and rigorous as possible. And so for me, the essay is always in a way sort of pulling in a couple of different, in at least two different directions. And when I try to put it as simply as possible, I suppose what gets me about great essayists, what draws me in, is the sense that on the one hand, the essay can literally encompass the world. And on the other hand, it has to be something, or I particularly like those essays that have a kind of refinement, a sort of precision about them.
Well, we might start at the beginning, Brian, and look at some of the great essays. One of the ones that you've chosen to begin the book with is the French philosopher and broad-based thinker Michel de Montaigne. Can you tell me about his contribution to the essay and the types of essays he wrote? Because I know he wrote about pretty much everything that he, I suppose, interfaced with in his own life.
Well, Montaigne starts in his essays by saying, by admitting that he's being completely subjective, that he's starting from his own experience. But that's the basis on which he's going to talk about, as you say, all of these other subjects. And the subjects range kind of extraordinarily between, you know, history, science, the far-flung parts of the world that he's heard accounts of. He has an essay on cannibals. He has an essay on noses. He has an essay on the idea of experience, on illness, and so on. So what he's trying to do, starting from his own position, you know, which is that of a French nobleman with sufficient leisure and learning to be able to undertake this as a project. He's trying to follow, as it were, his own intuitions and his own ideas, his own thoughts, wherever they will take him. And he knows, and he says it at the outset of the essays, that this is not an entirely original thing to do. There had been other writers in the past. You could think of something like St. Augustine and his Confession. Writers who start from the I, from the subjective position. But he's trying to combine that with as wide-ranging a kind of curiosity about the world as he possibly can. So Montaigne is kind of thought of conventionally as being the beginning of the European essay. And he's very, very quickly an influence on writers in English. He's translated very quickly. And so Shakespeare, for example, read Montaigne. And then he's hugely influential in the 17th century when you get the beginnings of an English essay tradition with people like Francis Bacon, with John Donne, the poet who also wrote extraordinary essays, Sir Thomas Browne, the great physician and essayist, and so on.
Virginia Woolf, the great British writer, believes that the essay must give pleasure, or that it was one of its distinguishing features. Do you agree with her on that?
I agree with her in the sense that what sets the essay apart in a way from other sorts of writing that it has an awful lot in common with, like, let's say, straightforward historical writing or academic criticism or a kind of more conventional autobiography, say, what sets it apart is that it's trying to do something with the relationship between reader and writer. that depends not only on getting your story across or your argument across, but on doing something with the language, doing something with the form of the essay. And so in a way, when Woolf says, you know, the essay has to give pleasure, it sounds very nice. It sounds like a kind of quite a mild ambition for a writer. But as we know, especially if we sit down and read Virginia Woolf's essays, it also means that every essay is a kind of experiment with the form, the voice of the essay. Woolf says elsewhere, she says the problem with writing essays is to be yourself and not be yourself at the same time. And that's very attractive to me, that idea that you are writing from a sort of stable position. You know who you are, but actually you put that self out into the world and it could become anything at all. So her notion of pleasure is not, I think, not an easy one. You know, it's a challenging sort of pleasure.
You write in your introductions, you say something on the lines of that you argue that please don't call the essay creative nonfiction or say the essay is the new novel. And you say the essay should instruct, seduce and mystify in equal measure.
Yeah, I took against, I suppose, the popular phrase creative nonfiction, which isn't really a phrase that any writer would use, I think, about themselves. It's a term that arises out of publishing and not from among writers. And it's sometimes used in creative writing classes and so on. I suppose that one of my objections to it is that it suggests that you can make a sort of straightforward choice, you know, to be a creative writer of nonfiction or a non-creative. And of course, these judgments are for other people to make, really. The essay is having a moment, you know, it's having a sort of phase the past few years where it's being talked up, especially by American critics like David Shields and John DeGatta, who've both written books on the subject, being kind of talked up as the place where all of the, or a lot of the kind of literary energy is going now into nonfiction instead of fiction. And I think that there's some truth in that. And I wouldn't be writing this book, I suppose, a book about the essay, unless I somehow believed in that. But I think at the same time that you can exaggerate these things and you can kind of begin to fetishize an idea of what it means to be creative in nonfiction. I suppose what I'm trying to avoid in this book is making a definition of the essay. And I think that a term like creative nonfiction just sounds a little too easy to me.
And slightly knobby, if you don't mind me saying so. What do you think George Perec offered the reader in terms of his writing, in terms of his essays and so on?
Oh, Perec is one of my favourites. Perec is most famous, I suppose, for his fiction, for novels like Life, A User's Manual, and great novel, which in French is called La Disparition, The Disappearance, but it can't be translated as The Disappearance because it's a novel entirely without the letter E. Perec is an experimentalist in fiction, but also in nonfiction. And some of his great essays are about tiny details of the world. He wrote an extraordinary piece in the mid-70s that describes simply the objects on his writing table. He wrote a short book, again in the mid-70s, in which he sits in a square in Paris, Place de Saint-Sulpice, I think, and he describes through a cafe window everything that he's seeing, buses passing by, pedestrians, children, dogs, etc. And so what he's interested in doing is tricking himself, as it were, into describing the world in the minutest, most detailed, strangest terms, because the risk he takes, the gamble he takes, is to say, you know, if you put a frame around the world in a particular way, it might just be a cafe window. It might be taking out one letter of the alphabet from your book. That constraint allows you to see all kinds of other things. So Perec, to me, is a real hero. He's also funny. He's light. You know, there's a quality of lightness in his writing that I think is often very important, and that in some way often distinguishes the essay from, let's say, more scholarly or academic kinds of writing, is that quality of a kind of delicacy but also humour.
He was a believer in the list, wasn't he? And he, as you said, he used to describe in detail lots of the kind of his belongings or whatever it was. I'm just wondering, you pitch up a very interesting question. You say, is there ever such a thing as a happy list in literature?
Yes, I'm really interested in lists in both in fiction and in non-fiction. And, you know, even if you read something like Perec's list of the objects on his table or the foods that he's eaten over the course of an entire year, which is another one of his essays, there's something funny about them, but there's also something melancholy about that act of listing. And with Perec, there's something sort of haunting that, which is the loss of his parents during the Second World War. And so he seems to have a kind of attachment to objects. They don't have to be objects that remind him directly of his parents, but they seem to embody something of memory of the past that he's trying to hang on to. So I was kind of interested in the book in what happens when an author simply lists things that they are seeing or experiencing. And it seemed to me there's something sort of doleful about lists. There are also strange things on the page. You know, the great lists in fiction, or the greatest lists in fiction, are probably the lists that appear in Ulysses, the lists of people who come to a funeral, the lists of trees that go on for page after page. And it's a strange form in some ways. And I think essayists often use it really, really interestingly.
Do you think there is a link between depression and the essay? I know that you write, writing any sort of writing has become a matter of distracting myself daily from the urge to destroy myself. Do you think the essay lends itself into kind of more probing and introspective writing in some ways?
So one of the things I was interested in doing in the book, or rather one of the things that happened while I was writing the book, was that it started to become about my own relationship with writing and with reading certain writers, essayists in this case, who seemed to have said something to me over the years about the experience of depression, which I have experienced myself on and off, but seemed in some ways not simply to help in a very straightforward way, but it seemed like there was some kind of relationship between my experience and what I was reading, or how I was reading those writers. There's a long history of essays about melancholy. The most famous in the 17th century is Robert Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy, in which he tries to say something about this disease or this disorder that seems to have overtaken him and many, many other people in that period. And he ends up writing about everything. You know, he ends up writing a whole kind of medical theological history of himself and the world around him. It's almost as if, you know, when you start writing an essay about melancholy or about depression, everything feeds into it. It becomes about everything else. So writing about that subject is a kind of particularly heightened version of the essay, I think.
I know that you mentioned quite a few books that were in your own family home when you were growing up, and how your own personal engagement with the essay. You came across Roland Barthes when you were in your late teens, I think. And it was at a time when your mother had died and that you were trying to reconcile yourself to the new realities of life and where you fitted in with life. Can you tell me about that?
Well, yes. I mean, when I was about 16, when I was more or less exactly 16, actually, in the summer of 1985, my mother died. She was only 50, and it wasn't entirely out of the blue, but it was still obviously a great shock and an extreme event in my adolescence. And I think in some ways I reacted by burying my nose in a book. And one of the things that I did regularly was we lived in Harold's Cross, and outside of Dublin, and we went to Rathmines Library regularly. And at the same time, I was reading a lot of music magazines, and there were writers at that period who used to refer to a whole kind of constellation of, you know, nonfiction writers, journalists mostly, people like Tom Wolfe and Norman Mailer's journalism, and Susan Sontag and Germaine Greer, and so on. And in among all these names was Roland Barthes, the great French critic and literary theorist, I suppose. And I discovered one of his books in the library, and really, to be honest, couldn't make head nor tail of it the first time. But I went back a year later and started to read him properly, and discovered this was a kind of extraordinary writer. What I didn't know at the time was that Bart had written a great book about the death of his own mother, Camera Lucida, which is partly a book about photography, about the nature of photography and the history of photography, but really is about the fact that he had just lost his mother a year before. So he's been a really pivotal writer for me, because he embodies this kind of point that I think to me is one of the most attractive things in any writer, in between the world of ideas and a much more vulnerable emotional state. And he's always somehow kind of floating in between these two things and never quite committing himself to being just an intellectual on the one hand or just a proper writer, as it were, on the other.
I haven't read any William Gass. How good is he and who should read him?
Everybody should read William Gass. William Gass is an amazing writer. He has written just a handful of novels, some of which are very short and most of which are very long. He's a great short story writer, but I think his most lasting thing, he's now about 90, still writing. His most lasting contribution, I think, is in his essays. He writes about all kinds of subjects, but he writes an awful lot about literature itself. And he's the most extraordinary stylist. The book of his that has been most important for me is a book called On Being Blue, which came out, I think, in 76 or 77. And it's supposedly a book about the color blue, but it ends up being about everything. It's a very short book, but it's just bristling. He has a very strange kind of intellectual, but kind of cheeky and sometimes salacious voice. And his writing just sounds delicious. It sounds like nothing else on earth. He's also a maker of lists. He's a great maker of lists. So yes, everybody should read William Gass and start with On Being Blue, which was reissued a couple of years ago.
You sprinkle some lovely passages from some terrific essays all through the book. And there was one that really stood out for me, and it was Elizabeth Hardwick's essay, A View of My Own. And it was what she wrote about the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas. I was wondering, could you read it out? Because it really is such a magnificent piece of writing.
Yeah, Elizabeth Hardwick is one of my favourite essayists. I only discovered her a few years ago, which is a bit shameful, really. I should have known about her before. She's probably best known because she was one of the founders of the New York Review of Books. She was also married to Robert Lowell, which was a difficult job in itself, I think. But she wrote a lot of extraordinary essays about literature. And one of the best is in her collection, A View of My Own, from 1962. And it's an essay about the death of Dylan Thomas. And I'm just going to read you a short passage from this because it does something really interesting, I think, at the level of both language and emotion. He died grotesquely like Valentino, with mysterious weeping women at his bedside. His last months, his final agonies, his utterly woeful end were a sordid and spectacular drama of broken hearts, angry wives, irritable doctors, frantic bystanders, rumors and misunderstandings, neglect and murderous permissiveness. The people near him visited indignities upon themselves, upon him, upon others. There seems to have been a certain amount of competition at the bedside, assertions of obscure priority. The horrors were more and more vague, confused by the ghastly suffering needs of this broken host and his final impersonality. There are so many strange things about that passage, including phrases like this broken host and his final impersonality that are quite unclear, but strangely compelling. But the thing that struck me about it was actually at the beginning of that passage when she says, he died grotesquely like Valentino. And I always read it when I read it the first few times as he died grotesquely like Valentino. But it's not, there's a comma. He died, comma, grotesquely like Valentino, comma, with mysterious weeping women at his bedside. And the strange placing of the comma does something curious, I think. You sort of trip up on it. And for me, one of the great things about Hardwick, and maybe this is one of the great things that the essay itself can do, is to give you the kind of emotional content, but it does it in this way that estranges it at the same time. And that happens with a great, really skilled writer, skilled essayist like Hardwick. It happens even at the level of where she places a comma.
And that creates a magical space between the writer and the reader, because you're discovering, and it's also quite active, isn't it?
I think so. You're forced to kind of go back and reread. Susan Sontag said somewhere in her diary that people said about Hardwick that it was as if she wrote by leaving every second sentence out. And Sontag thought that was a good thing. You know, she doesn't explain everything. A writer like Susan Sontag, who I also love, kind of wanted to explain everything. You know, she wanted to be absolutely as clear as possible, and that's the kind of great virtue of her prose. But somebody like Hardwick is content to leave certain things out or to choose somewhat strange words, to arrange her sentences in these somewhat eccentric patterns, and then something else happens. She said herself that the greatest influences on her own writing were the prose writings of poets. So when poets turned to writing autobiography or criticism, say, these were the things that she really liked. And I think that you can hear that. You can hear this particular, not quite poetic, because poetic prose can be a bit limp, a little bit affected. But there's something kind of much more rigorously poetic in Hardwick.
You have some very interesting stuff on Susan Sontag. And, you know, she was such a prolific writer and had such an impact on culture and intellectual discourse and on lots of things. And she spoke, she was quite an activist on a lot of different social issues and so far reaching in a lot of different ways. But one of the curious things about her is that she suffered tremendously from self-doubt. And that really came out in the diaries her son brought out a couple of years ago. It's fascinating to see how you can get superb essays, terrific books, outstanding interviews from these great public intellectuals, yet in their private life, crippled with anxiety.
Absolutely. I mean, in Sontag's case, her public persona was mostly so confident, so assured on the page and in person. But one of the things, there are now, I think there are three volumes of her diaries that, as you say, were edited and published by her son after she died. And I was interested partly in the fact that, you know, diaries might be a form of essay in a way. And that with a writer like Sontag, you're getting, in a way, sort of the same writer in the diaries and her notebooks, but in some ways a very different writer. And the diaries are the place where she invents Susan Sontag. You know, she can see her, even as a teenager, telling herself how to become a writer. She doesn't just do the things that lots of beginning writers do, making lists of books that she's read, books that she should read, words that she's found attractive or interesting that she might use in her writing and so on. But she literally says to herself, you know, don't smile so much. You know, don't be so charming. Don't be so eager to please. She's training herself to be the most exacting, the hardest thinker, you know, the most clear and sort of diamond sharp thinker. And that doesn't involve pleasing people. And she has to remind herself to do that. She's also, as adolescence goes on, and then in as a young adult, and actually well all the way through the diaries, you know, until well into middle age, she's also suffering. You know, she finds kind of disappointments in her love life absolutely agonizing. And she's constantly undermining herself. You know, she's constantly unsure of herself, even in the 1970s and 80s, when you would imagine that she, a writer like Sontag, would feel completely at home in the world of letters, surrounded by great writers and intellectuals and so on, having published so much. But she's still absolutely riven with doubt. And there's an extraordinary moment, I think around 1980 in the diary, where she says, I think at last I might be able to write.
She had an extraordinary life and she had quite a difficult relationship with her son who brought out the diaries. And there's so many different contradictions within her thinking as well. I'm just wondering, do you think it's fair to say that she curated herself in some way, or do you think that's pushing it?
I think that she saw her writing as in some way slightly separate from herself in a way that's quite striking. You know, she sees the essay as a thing that she places out into the world and it can then be judged by others. But it's different, I think, from the way that a novelist might think about writing one big work, one great work at a time. As an essayist, you are producing these small artifacts and then sending them out into the world and then getting started on some more small, short essays. Essay writing never feels like it never ends, I think, for someone like Sontag. But it is also about then, I think, a kind of, as you say, curating of the objects that you've made. So So one of the things that I really like about the essay as a form is that the essay collection is such a strange literary beast in a way. And a writer like Sontag mostly wrote essay collections. And it's easy to forget that some of her greatest works are just collections of things that appeared in magazines and journals and so on. And there is a almost accidental sense that, you know, after several years, you package up all of these things and they become a work like a great book, like Sontag's Against Interpretation. And sometimes I think that with Sontag, sometimes later on, she tried a little too hard to curate those essays. And they seem, by the 70s and certainly 80s, they seem a little more ponderous, a little more pompous. So I think there's a problem about the kind of self-consciousness of calling yourself an essayist and curating these things, these perfectly made things that you've brought into the world. It sometimes can kind of work against the spontaneity or energy of the essay.
God, it's all so interesting, Brian. I might get you to read a bit of Sontag. Where would you like to read from?
I'm going to read from her diary from 1959. And she's talking here in this passage about the relationship between her writing and her sex life and her love life. And it's a really interesting passage to me because she makes this very clear connection between writing and desire and ego. So here's Sontag. The orgasm focuses. I lust to write. The coming of the orgasm is not the salvation, but more the birth of my ego. I cannot write until I find my ego. The only kind of writer I could be is the kind who exposes himself. To write is to spend oneself, to gamble oneself. But up to now, I have not even liked the sound of my own name. To write, I must love my name. The writer is in love with himself and makes his book out of that meeting and that violence.
Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm joined by Irish writer, memorist and cultural critic Brian Dillon, whose latest publication, Essayism, has just been published by Fitzcarraldo Editions. I asked Brian about the art of the bon mot and where he stands on it all.
One of the things I talk about in the book is the idea of the fragment, which is really important in essay writing, both inside essays and as a kind of essay writing in itself. And so when you say the bon mot, the kind of witticism, there's a long history of thinking about how those things are made, about how fragments and epigrams and aphorisms are made. In the 16th and 17th century, there's a whole theory about these things that, oddly enough, developed mostly by Jesuit writers about the aphorism or the witticism as a kind of dagger, you know, as a weapon, as a rhetorical device for literally skewering your opponent in argument. And I was interested in the way that that developed. You know, there are great writers later on who write almost entirely in fragments. The French writer La Rochefoucauld, who writes his Maxims, or Pascal with his Pensées, and then a lot of especially German romantic writers like Schlegel, who write in fragments. And Schlegel says somewhere that the great writers of Greek and Roman literature have come down to us often merely as fragments. That's all that's left. But modern writers aspire to write in fragments. So this is a very interesting idea that the fragment, the tiny, perfectly formed piece of writing, is the most modern form of writing. I wonder whether in essay writing or in any other kind of writing, it's even possible to think like that anymore. It's very hard to think that there are great, profound writers anymore who write in epigrams or witticisms. In some ways, Wilde was the last. You know, after that, it becomes a very, very difficult thing to do. People have tried, and I have a section in the book about Cyril Connolly, the great English critic, who during the Second World War wrote a book called The Unquiet Grave, which is a strange collection of fragments, some of them kind of autobiographical, some of them critical, some of them philosophical, in which he's trying to express his own kind of melancholic state during the war. But he keeps doing it by making jokes. He can't stop himself making jokes and one-liners. Some of them are very famous, although people might not know that they come from Cyril Connolly. The best one is probably, "Inside every fat man, there's a thin man wildly signaling to get out," which lots of other people have claimed for themselves, I think, as a joke. But it doesn't quite work as a book. It's a sort of strange failure. And I think that idea of the perfectly formed one-liner as a serious literary form is something that you can't really take all that seriously anymore.
I was delighted to see that you finished the book up on some contemporary essayists, and one of them that you chose to write about was one of America's most talented writers, David Foster Wallace. He had an extraordinary life and unfortunately a very short life, but a lot of his essays are available online now, and they're so broad, so dynamic, so lively and so shrewd in so many different ways. He had such an acute eye for observing all the different contradictions and the mundane in life, didn't he?
David Foster Wallace says somewhere, I think it's in one of his essays, that he thinks about the essay as essentially a huge eyeball floating around its subject, attempting to see everything, you know, and attempting to describe everything. And I think you're right, you know, in his essays, which in many ways, I think like a lot of readers, I prefer to his fiction, even though I greatly admire novels like Infinite Jest. I think that in the essays, he perfects that level of extraordinary attention to the world, whether he's writing about tennis or going to a convention or an awards ceremony for producers of pornography, or whether he's going on a cruise ship to try and write about that experience. Whatever he's doing, he pays the most extraordinary, acute kind of attention. But at the same time, it's all undercut by this rather flatterish, self-deprecating, hugely intelligent and erudite, but somehow failing persona that he developed. And you see that formally in the essays, including, as you say, the ones that many of which are online, the things he wrote for magazines, especially in the 90s. You see that a lot of the time in the form of the essay, which kind of dissolves into footnotes and things in the margins. He's constantly kind of undercutting himself. And that kind of self-consciousness, I suppose some readers can find it a little annoying. I find it really endearing in his case, because it's like this is the same voice, but it's also, well, actually, this is the voice that is pointing to the great authorial voice and saying, well, actually, really, are you sure? Maybe not. There's a very, to my mind, human kind of self-consciousness going on in David Foster Wallace.
If you were to direct listeners to maybe 5 or 10 of the greatest essays of all time, or from any particular century, we could look at the 20th century or whatever, what would they be and for what reason?
What would they be? Well, I'm looking, as you speak, at the bibliography of my book and thinking, what would the greatest be? I don't have a hierarchy when it comes to essays. So I'm going to name a few that I think might be less well known to some readers. There's an extraordinary essay that, in fact, I've just written an article about for a magazine in New York by Annie Dillard from around 1980, which is about her experience of total eclipse of the sun a year earlier in 79. And it's just the most extraordinarily vivid and strange description of what she sees, what she experiences, and the reactions of people who are with her. I, again, to my shame, only started reading Annie Dillard about a year ago, but I think that she's an amazing essayist. Who else? Thomas de Quincey in 1821 in his Confessions of an English Opium Eater essentially kind of invents the modern autobiography and also, I suppose, invents the modern drug memoir. But he's at the level of, you know, the voice, again, a kind of really endearing, very learned, very intelligent, but at the same time, sort of melancholic, sort of hapless figure who's constantly trying to get himself out of his addiction to opium and can't do it. But that's what produces the writing. That's what produces this amazing literary voice.
And what about the likes of Joan Didion or some of those types of writers?
Didion, I absolutely love, and I imagine that among the essayists that I write about in the book, Joan Didion is one of the best known. The essay of hers that I possibly love most is one that people don't talk about so much, even though it's in her great collection, The White Album. And it's an essay about the Hoover Dam, which she visited at some point in the late 60s, I think, and she writes about it in the early 70s. And she writes about this experience of going to see this famous object, you know, this great work of engineering that's also a kind of monument to early 20th century kind of technological American ambition, and finding the experience weirdly unsettling. You know, she's fixated after she leaves for months by the strange feeling of this energy coursing through the dam. It's a very, very short piece. But extraordinarily compelling and strange. And of course, it's about something that you don't really expect Joan Didion to write about, engineering. I suppose I would also want to go back to Virginia Woolf. I write a bit in the book about her extraordinary essay on being ill. She was asked around 1928, I think, by T.S. Eliot to write something for the magazine that he was editing, the New Criterion. And she was unwell at the time. She had flu and she had backache and headache, but was also obviously depressed. And she wrote something out of this experience of being in bed, sick. And On Being Ill starts with a kind of sensible set of arguments about why there isn't all that much literary writing about sickness itself. Sickness appears in novels, you know, deathbed scenes and so on. But there are very few writers. Maybe Thomas de Quincey and Marcel Proust would be the exceptions, she says, who really address illness. And so she wants to imagine what a literature that's really about sickness would sound like. And this essay goes on for a few pages, and then quite abruptly, it suddenly swerves into talking about a kind of 19th century potboiler biography of various aristocrats. And the essay ends just with Wolfe repeating a scene from this terrible book that she's been reading while she's sick. And the point of it, the point of that strange digression, is that that's what the sick mind does, she says. Even when you've just got a mild case of flu, your mind wanders in this slightly delirious state. You make strange connections between things, between what you're reading and your own experience, and fantasy, and so on. And so it's a great example of the essay mimicking in its own language and in its own form the thing that it's talking about.
Was Irish writer, scholar and cultural critic Brian Dillon. Essayism is published by Fitzcarraldo Editions and retails for just under €12 in paperback or €7 on an e-book. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the candid words of French philosopher, cultural critic and essayist Roland Barthes, who once quipped, "Each of us has its own rhythm of suffering." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.